This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. American colleges and universities are facing a so-called enrollment cliff, a precipitous drop in college-age applicants. Consider the state of Illinois, where the population of high school seniors peaked in 2015 and has been dropping ever since. Nationwide, since the start of the pandemic, the number of Americans applying to college is down by almost a million. Over the last decade, it's dropped by almost 3 million. There's also a student debt crisis and a debate about the actual value of a college degree. All this means growing uncertainty for institutions of higher learning, especially for hundreds of small colleges across the country, schools that are particularly dependent upon tuition payments. A declining applicant pool means less money to pay professors, maintain facilities, and fund extracurriculars like sports, clubs, and student life. Some colleges are already making cuts. Others are shutting down. So what is their path forward? How can small colleges thrive and survive? Well, joining us now is Linda Oubre. She's the president of Whittier College. That's a four-year private liberal arts college in Los Angeles County with about 1,300 students. Last year, Whittier cut its football, golf, and lacrosse programs. And President Oubre, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's really good of you to be here. And we've laid out some of the challenges facing smaller schools. I'm wondering if you could just tell us how Whittier is faring these days.
You know, we're doing great. One of the things I'm most proud of is that we took the pandemic as an opportunity to think differently about our future. You know, all of the trends that you're talking about challenged small colleges even before the pandemic. And I like to say, I think the pandemic sped things up. And we have spent a lot of time rethinking our future and thinking strategically about who we want to be in the future.
Interesting. Well, I want to talk about some of those specifics. But first, tell us something about Whittier, because yesterday, my esteemed colleague Jack Beatty reminded us that among its claim to fame, former President Richard Nixon was a graduate. But tell us more about Whittier and what it's known for today.
Yes, we are Richard Nixon's alma mater. We're located about halfway between downtown LA and downtown Disney, as we like to say, in southeast Los Angeles County. And we are officially a minority-serving institution. And about 70% students of color, 50% Latinx. And I think as a small college with all the trends and demographic trends that you're talking about, one of the trends is that the proportion of students of color is expected to increase significantly in coming decades, especially Latinx. So in some ways, we're a small college and have those challenges, but we also have a great opportunity because we look like what a lot of small colleges want to look like in terms of our student body.
Now, we did mention Whittier's decision to cut football, golf, and lacrosse programs. Tell us why that was necessary. And I have to imagine that was a difficult decision to make. But can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, always difficult. But we also, even before the pandemic, started talking about realigning our resources to our mission. And our mission is our diverse students and ensuring their success. So we started talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and support of student success and realigning our resources, even realigning our fundraising around student success and ensuring that our students graduate. And every dime, I like to say, every dime that we spend comes out of the pocket of our students in the form of student loans for the rest of their lives. And so we need to really think smartly and strategically about what we're spending our money on. So for us, we've also have a vision of not just athletics, which we believe in, but health and wellness. And we all have heard that one of the trends in the pandemic is that the mental health crisis for all of us, but especially for our student going population, is increasing. And so we wanted to be able to realign some resources and talk about health and wellness and how important health and wellness is.
So does that mean cutting football, golf, and lacrosse essentially freed up resources for new programs that address health and wellness? What would those programs be?
Well, new programs definitely in health and wellness. Also our academic offerings, because we have to prioritize what the mission is. But yeah, we have launched physical activity programs. So for us, you know, athletics is not just NCAA. It's also Pilates classes and yoga classes. Also being able to offer more mental health counseling. We've also have, because we shifted our fundraising focus, we've also been able to get a lot of fundraising dollars in support of mental health counseling and things like that that students really need right now.
Right. If one of the challenges facing small colleges is declining student enrollment, doesn't that kind of decision, and by that kind of decision I'm talking about cutting big sports programs, does that make the school less attractive to many potential applicants?
Well, it's our job to ensure that we are attractive to students and students of the future. And so part of what we're also doing is looking at the students of today and tomorrow and what sorts of things that they are interested in. We all know that there's declining interest in tackle football in particular in the pipeline, Pop Warner. But also we're looking in and have launched things like esports, which at least in Southern California is getting very, very popular and is actually gender diverse, which is really good as well. So, you know, we need to talk to students, especially as a Division III school, not just about football, but about chemistry, about math, about English, about theater, about arts, and about the great careers that they can choose if they graduate from Whittier College.
I'm interested to hear more, too. You mentioned sort of at the top of the segment how the pandemic prompted you to sort of rethink aspects of your mission and the way you do business. What else sort of tops that list?
You know, a big part of it is thinking about how to use technology.
Right.
Like a lot of institutions, we pivoted in 2 weeks to remote. And we learned that we can bring a lot of elements of this intimate small college to a remote format, which surprises a lot of people. Our faculty did a fantastic job. Of course, we had bumps along the road like everyone, but I'm really, really proud of the faculty and how creative, because we felt it was important not to just go online, but to think about how we can bring parts of that intimate education. So one of my favorite examples is people always say, how do you do labs remote? And we had a very creative chemistry professor who figured out that all the labs she needed for her class could be done in a kitchen with normal kitchen ingredients. And so she sent out a list to the students of what they can purchase via Amazon that could be delivered, and did her labs using kitchen elements. You know, just very, very creative. We had other faculty who felt that a good way for the classes to connect was to spend the first 10 or 15 minutes and just let the students talk among themselves on Zoom, to catch up, to talk about their issues, et cetera. That was very, very important to have a way for students to connect, even though we were remote.
So, President Ubre, you know, one of the things we kicked off this segment talking about is this so-called enrollment cliff. And I'm just wondering how Whittier has experienced that. I mean, have you seen fewer applicants? And if so, how are you dealing with that? I mean, you've talked about ways how to attract new students. I get that. But have you seen, experienced that enrollment cliff, that enrollment cliff, that precipitous drop-off in college applicants?
Yes, you know, like most institutions we have, particularly that first year for fall 2020, we've been inching back up. Each new class is a little bigger than that first class, but we're inching back up to get to, we hope, where we were before. Applications also have been down, but we're also seeing some interesting trends as well. We're noticing that the grade point averages are higher. We're also noticing that the expected family contribution is higher, which I don't necessarily think is a good thing, but the trends are very interesting.
Yeah. What does that tell you, that the GPA is higher? Why do you think that is?
I think that what we're getting now, and we see it in Southern California in particular, the community colleges continue to suffer in Southern California and California. Even the publics, the California State University, several of their campuses are really suffering in enrollment as well. And I think part of it is that students are thinking about what they want to do with their lives right now and thinking about what the best options are for their lives. Where, you know, also LA County had very strict COVID rules, and higher ed was the most strict within LA County public health rules. And so last fall was really the first time we're really able to get back. We're still wearing masks indoors in higher ed, at least on this campus. And so it definitely hurt things like campus visits. We were just able to start that back up last fall, and visiting high schools, et cetera. So we're trying to rethink everything, even in terms of enrollment. We're really trying to double down on our local market. We also are doubling down on the transfer market, because the cliff is with traditional age college students, but there's expected increases in non-traditional students and people who constantly want to reskill. So we also have launched Lux Whittier, which is essentially certificate type programs. You know, I may already have a degree in history. Maybe I want to do coding, or maybe I don't have a degree, but I want to spend, you know, take a coding class, or we have a creative writing class, you know, short sort of certificate programs that I can upskill and learn. And that is actually, we think, a growing market.
Right. We have about a minute left before we have to go to a break, but I'm reading that something like 12 colleges a year are closing, most of them small colleges. And I'm wondering, what's the best argument in favor of these schools? What do we lose when these colleges struggle and close?
Well, I'll tell you what Whittier does, because I think that it's a best practice. With our diversity, our most successful students are women of color. And a third of the population of California are women of color. And we have found a way to educate a population that industry needs to drive the economy. And and particularly in areas like STEM. So it's a very intimate, personal education. And colleges like us are being very successful at it.
All right. Well, listen, we're Linda Oubre, president of Whittier College. Stay with us. We've got a lot more to talk about this hour. Listeners, we are talking about this enrollment cliff and what it means, particularly to the nation's several hundred small colleges. A lot more when we get back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking today about the decline in college enrollment and what that means for the future of small colleges. We're joined by Linda Oubre. She's president of Whittier College, a four-year private liberal arts school in Los Angeles County. It has about 1,300 students. We're also joined now, happy to introduce Lee Gardner. He's senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's done a lot of work on this, including a piece that came out last summer called The Perilous Predicament of the Very Small College. Lee Gardner, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been listening along to President Oubre. I'd love to get your reaction and tell us about your reporting on the challenge facing small colleges. What's going on? How do you sort of sum up the challenge?
Well, small colleges have always had a little bit of a difficult time just because, you know, as President Oubre mentioned, they're very tuition dependent. And so anything that might affect the number of students they have coming in can cause outsized changes. You know, if they miss 10 or 20 students in a class, that has ramifications for them, whereas at a larger institution, that's not such a big deal. And in the current environment, it's much more competitive for those students. And so, you know, she mentioned trying to think differently. And I think that these small colleges are, if they haven't been doing that already, are really trying to do that now, to try to find a way to define themselves in such a way that they stand out among their peers, because there are, you know, hundreds, thousands of small colleges of various sizes and types. And, you know, the students have a lot of choice these days. It's a buyer's market.
Right. I'm looking, too, at the results, some of the consequences of the pandemic, and I learned from your reporting, as you write, financially, COVID-19 should have been much worse for all these colleges, but the federal government doled out $77 billion in aid through the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. You also mentioned that the stock market performed unexpectedly well during the pandemic, fattening endowments. But those two factors, which insulated many colleges, as you write, these smaller colleges, from layoffs and cutbacks, those federal dollars are going away. So what does that mean? Does that mean that as bad as the challenge is today, that it might well get worse?
Oh, certainly. And there are additional challenges. For example, the inflation that's been going around recently. I had a college president tell me just this week that the cost of replacing a roof on a building at his institution has doubled from before the pandemic. And so when you're on a tight budget, that's an issue. And it's also important to keep in mind that for a lot of colleges, their market is the area immediately around the institution. The demographic cliff, so to speak, isn't evenly distributed. It's worst in the upper Midwest and in the Northeast. A lot of states are expected to gain students, but these small colleges especially compete on a national level, some of them, many of them. And so they're looking to draw students from all over the country. And so they may be able to rely on that local market, but they're competing with all these other colleges just as well. So they don't really catch a break that way.
President Oubre, I want to get you back in this conversation. I just want to ask Lee one more question about his reporting, and that is we talked about this enrollment cliff. And again, I learned from you that as bad as it is right now, it's going to get even worse, right?
Yes. There's a scholar named Nathan Graw who is cited about this a lot and has done a lot of work. A lot of states are expected to lose as many as 15 or as much as 15% of their high school graduates by the year 2032, and as much of the college-going high school graduates by 2029, I believe. And of course, now a lot of demographers are concerned that COVID is going to create an additional dip in the demographics out further than that. So colleges are going to be looking at an increasingly competitive landscape for traditional age students, at least, for years to come.
So, President Oubre, how does Whittier College prepare for that? I appreciate a lot of what you told me in the first segment of the program, but this enrollment cliff gets even steeper in years to come. Is Whittier ready?
We are ready. I think that we are beneficiaries of one of the comments that was made about the geographic area. You know, Southern California will continue to grow, not as much as it has in the past, at least for the next couple of years, because of cost of living, inflation, et cetera. But we have a growing population, particularly of Latinx students. And so that's one reason we're doubling down on the local market, which was a market that Whittier, in an effort to become more national, had really pulled resources away from the local market. So we're doubling down on that market, but also, you know, thinking differently, as I said before, and as you mentioned, we're going to continue to think differently. We think there's a lot of growth, again, in that non-traditional age market. Thinking differently means that we have to use technology. We have to think about doing hybrid classes, using our physical campus where it makes sense. So, for instance, Experiential Learning Center is something that we're looking to launch, but maybe a lecture, an entrepreneurship class can be done online, and then the student goes to the Experiential Learning Center for their Shark Tank group project in front of corporations. So really, really thinking about what the student experience is for the students of the future and who the students of the future are.
Right. President Oubre, you've worked for higher ed institutions, both large and small. You're at Whittier now, and we're defining that as a small school. You held senior positions at UC Davis. You were dean at San Francisco State University. Now you're at Whittier. I'm wondering if you can just sort of talk about how these different size institutions are dealing with this enrollment cliff and other challenges. What are the difference between large and small schools?
You know, it's funny because people ask me all the time that question, what's the difference? I focus on the students. And so the students are very similar at the institutions that I've been at with similar needs. You know, the publics like San Francisco State, in particular, the California State University, which is 23 campuses, and then the University of California has 10 campuses, and they're the R1 research institutions. But the California State University campuses, as I mentioned earlier, several of them are also experiencing large enrollment cliffs. Great education, it tends to be the campuses that are in higher cost of living areas such as San Francisco, and also some of the trends that we're seeing with students rethinking education. The other thing I'm watching closely is that there's been some studies out of the publics in California that after COVID, about half the students want online options and hybrid options. So I think even the students have changed in terms of how they're looking at convenience. You know, as a small college, definitely, we can say it 20,000 times, we're tuition dependent.
Right.
But we're also dependent on the enrollment, which means that if you have 10 less students, as was mentioned, that's 10 less people living in the residence halls with 98% margins. And so, you know, our federal money that we got, relief money, barely covered the loss in revenue from room and board for us during the pandemic.
I see.
So we're thinking differently. We actually did a deal with our local community college because they have a high demand of housing. It's expensive in LA County. So we are housing Rio Hondo Community College students in our residence halls. So thinking differently about everything.
President Oubre, Lee Gardner, stand by. We're talking about how smaller colleges are struggling in the face of declining enrollment. Another challenge, a growing debate about their value, given the rising cost of tuition and a crippling student debt crisis. So to be blunt, the question is the return on investment, the so-called ROI, worth it? Well, Martin Vanderwerf, he directs editorial and education policy at Georgetown University Center for Education and the Workforce, has studied this, and here's a bit of what he says.
They actually have very good ROI. We theorize that it's probably because a lot of those students go on to graduate school. Some of those colleges tend to be the biggest feeders of law schools, medical schools, other graduate programs. And people who go to graduate programs tend to have a pretty big ROI because we know that people with more education generally have higher earnings.
Now, in 2020, the Georgetown Center published a study that focused on 210 liberal arts colleges across the country. It found the median return on investment 40 years after enrollment approached $1 million. So that's pretty good. But it's not the whole story. The Georgetown study focused on 210 larger schools with more established reputations that can attract students from across the country. Vanderwerf says that while there's no specific data from the study, he estimates the smaller, less well-known schools offer a return of investment probably a bit lower, 10 to 20% lower, he estimates.
We think that the larger schools tend to draw more highly qualified, more diverse student body, and that results generally in higher graduation rates and then higher success rates in the market afterwards. So a lot of it just has to do with recognition.
Vanderwerf says that lower return on investment by the smaller schools needs to be put into context because he says many of these schools have student populations that come from the local region, and many graduates end up staying local, where in many cases the cost of living is usually lower. Still, declining enrollment, he says, presents a particular challenge for these schools.
They tend to be in smaller communities, and so the draw of a larger city with more entertainment and more employment possibilities is not there for a lot of these colleges, and a lot of young people are looking for that. And the birth rates in rural areas that would feed into these colleges are also declining, and so therefore, these colleges are having to look outside of their traditional areas for new students. And that's pretty hard to do when you don't have a lot of name recognition.
So that's Martin van der Werf. He's director of editorial and education policy at the Georgetown University Center on Education and Workforce. President Linda Oubre, I want to come back to you. I know he was talking about smaller colleges in urban in rural areas. Whittier, of course, is not an example of that. But what do you hear in his argument and what he says about return on investment? What's your view of that?
You know, I am an MBA as well and a former corporate executive, so and a first-generation college attendee. So I definitely saw the benefit of education and graduate school. Yeah. And I think it goes, for Whittier, goes back to our best practice. And we are graduating students, in particular women of color, who go into STEM fields and go to graduate school. So I definitely see that for Whittier. And I think having gone to a large public myself undergrad, you know, we don't have a viewpoint of weeding out students in organic chemistry for medical school. We find a way to meet students and help them achieve what their goal is. So that they can be successful and go into the career that they want. The other thing that I do think is missed in some of the data, particularly for Whittier, is one of our largest programs is education. And we do not value teachers, K through 12 teachers, enough in the United States. And how do you put an ROI on the fact that we graduate a lot of teachers, a lot of the principals in public schools in LA County are Whittier graduates? So the incomes are lower, but they're changing the world in different ways. And we also have a lot of our graduates in particular because, you know, 45% of our students are first gen and 40% are Pell, and they want to give back. So we have a lot of students also go into government and not-for-profit. So I hope that we can get to the point where we're really looking at ROI as more than a financial calculation, and that's an MBA saying that.
Right. No, and I think that's a great point. And ROI, of course, return on investment, just for listeners who might have missed that. I think we're having this debate about ROI because of this talk that we're hearing year after year about the huge sort of student debt crisis. So put that in perspective. I mean, we hear of people graduating with tens of thousands of dollars in debt that they're paying off and, you know, causing them to delay having families and set up careers and establish, buy a home and all that sort of stuff. So I think that's where questions about ROI come in. But so respond to that, if you would.
Is this for Lee or for Linda?
For you, Linda. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I personally think that affordability is probably the issue for higher ed. And I think, again, I think COVID just brought it more to the forefront. We are spending a lot of time at Whittier, and I'm sure it's happening at small colleges across the country, because the other thing that is difficult in the business model, and the business model was broken before COVID, is that our discount rates have been increasing. And a lot of us have discount rates that are over 50%. And so part of what we've been looking at Whittier is because of the students we serve, our competition is not necessarily the other small colleges. And we have data that shows the students who we admit who turn us down go to the California State University.
Interesting.
And the California State campuses and two UC schools, UC Riverside and Irvine. You know, you can go for $25,000 a year, including room and board, or you can live at home. And, you know, so we are really trying to rethink that. We launched an effort to attract more community college students. We have a community college advantage program for students who attend California community colleges that basically has a lower sticker price. To attract more of those students, because we know there's a lot of students who don't even apply because all they see is sticker price.
Right, right. Yeah. They see is sticker price, not taking into account that there are all kinds of discounts and grants and loans that can really bring that sticker price down, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And we don't have the answer. If we had the answer, everyone would be doing it, but we're trying to figure it out.
Right. It's a big challenge for schools across the country. Lee Gardner, I want to come back to you about this return on investment. In your reporting, what's your take? How do students feel about this return on investment of small colleges today? What do you make of it?
Well, I think small colleges tend to offer a particular thing that a lot of students still value. But I think for a lot of students, it's maybe an increasingly tough sell just because of a lot of the things we're already talking about, in the sense that there's a lot of question about the value of a college degree. You know, there's been some evidence that more young men are skipping college or doing something besides college, traditional college, because they don't feel like it's for them. It doesn't offer them what they're looking for. And the cost narrative that's out there certainly contributes to that. And I think that there's something to be said for sure regarding the tuition discounting and you know, colleges sort of giving themselves a self-inflicted wound with sticker price versus what people actually pay.
Lee Gardner, senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Stick with us. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. We're discussing the challenge facing higher education that has exacerbated the concerns about the future of small colleges. Linda Oubre, president of Whittier College in L.A. County, thank you so much for joining us today. We've really appreciated having you on the program. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
We'll be back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and a quick word about something we're working on for next week. We're going to be talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion training, and we want to hear from you. Has your workplace, your office, your business, school, or organization offered this kind of training? Did you participate? How did it go? What do you think about it? Share your experience with diversity, equity, and inclusion training by recording a message in the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for the On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. Or you can leave us a voicemail at this number, 617-353-0683. Again, that number is 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing the challenges facing higher education and how that's exacerbated the concerns about the future of small colleges. We're joined by Lee Gardner. He's a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And joining us now is Marjorie Haas. She's the president of the Council of Independent Colleges, an association of more than 650 independent liberal arts colleges and universities. And Marjorie Haas, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, you heard our conversation with President Linda Oubre. I was really happy to have her on the show. What struck you about what's happening at Whittier College and how, you know, she sounded pretty bullish about Whittier's future and about confronting the challenges facing smaller colleges?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I think it's important to note how important effective leadership is at these times of tumultuous change. And Whittier is very fortunate to have a president with her passion, her skills, and her willingness to confront the challenges face on. I think she is certainly not alone. I work with presidents every day across the country that are bringing similar entrepreneurial and creative thinking to their work and are really doing what needs to be done to help their colleges flourish. My own experience as a college president earlier in my career reminds me how difficult that work is. And it was very inspiring to hear her tell the story of what she has been able to accomplish at Whittier.
So what do these smaller schools have to do? We heard President Oubre talking about doubling down on online technology, hybrid classes, doubling down on reaching out to local residents as well as folks across the country and attracting non-traditional students. Those all sound like good ideas to keep these smaller schools solvent and relevant. What else do they have to do?
Well, a few things to point out. One is that, you know, the demographic cliff is not a surprise. That piece our institutions have been able to plan for. We know 18 years ahead of time how many 18-year-olds are going to be there, 18 years hence. So that piece institutions have really been able to think about and plan for. One of the trends we've seen has been the expansion of graduate programs and certificate programs. Of our CIC members, for example, 78% of them offer some form of credentialing and degree beyond the BA. That has been an important piece. Adult learning, degree completion, transfer programs, all of those have been expanded and are continuing to expand as institutions think about how to respond to a diminishment in the population of 18 to 22-year-olds.
Right. You know, you mentioned, by the way, that we've known about this enrollment cliff because we can look at birth rates and predict what's going to happen. So I'm looking, for example, Lee Gardner mentioned work by Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen, who predicted that half of all American this was back in 2017, and he predicted that half of all American colleges and universities are bound for bankruptcy in 10 to 15 years, he said. And he argued that online education would undermine traditional institutions' business models. That was a pretty dark prediction. Are we headed in that direction, or is it not as bad as that?
Well, I don't think the evidence bears out that kind of dire prediction. It really underestimates a few things. One is, again, the creativity and stability of our institutions. It also underestimates, I think, the need that young people have for a learning environment that is personally supportive.
Mm-hmm. Right. Say more about that. Personally supportive.
Well, we heard for a long time that, say, first those MOOC courses were going to be the end of residential colleges. Then we've heard that online education will replace all of that. But again, we know that young people learn best in a context of relationship, in a context of support, in a context that helps them draw connections between what they're learning. It doesn't mean that can't happen in an online environment. But as Dr. Oubre pointed out, and as I know from my own experience, both as a professor and a college president, effective online education is often just as expensive or nearly as expensive to provide as face-to-face education.
Right. Lee Gardner, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I'm wondering, in the reporting that you've done, can you talk about any positive consequences of this enrollment decline? I mean, maybe compelling schools like Whittier and like some of the other schools that Marjorie Haas is talking about to innovate and think creatively and do things differently.
I think that there are plenty of people in higher education who would say that the current conditions are forcing a lot of colleges to make changes or at least think about changes that probably they should have made, 5, 10, 20 years ago in some cases. Getting rid of some of the redundancy in terms of academic offerings, rethinking their business models, some of the more extreme cases, looking at some market efficiencies. I'm not a big market person. But in some parts of the country, maybe there are too many colleges, even though it would be terrible for the communities they're in if some of them closed or were forced to merge or things like that. And the thing is, Clay Christensen has made dire predictions about things like that as part of his disruptor guise. But the truth is colleges die really hard. People have been predicting for as long as I've been writing about higher ed, there's going to be a massive die-off of colleges, and it never really seems to arrive. As you pointed out at the top, about a dozen colleges, nonprofit colleges, close every year, and that number has been more or less steady for at least the last decade. So, you know, if it's going to happen, I mean, maybe it will, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Marjorie House, what do you think? I mean, I'm reading that, as Lee mentioned, something like 12 colleges a year are closing. Most of them are small colleges. Is that a number that you're okay with? Is that a number that's going to go up, down? What do you think?
Well, you know, when I think about this, I want to think about it really in terms of the students that are served.
Right.
Because, you know, we could sort of objectively say, yes, market contraction, not always a bad thing. But again, when you think about the colleges and those communities, so the colleges that seem to be most vulnerable to closure are the very small institutions, those with, say, under 1,000 students. In the CIC universe, we have about 135 such institutions. They serve collectively over 91,000, just over 91,000 students. So one question would be, if each of those institutions closed, which again, I don't think would happen, but if they did, what would be the educational alternative for those students? Would they find a place at public institutions? Is the state prepared to invest in educating those students? Our collective CIC institutions give away $5 billion in institutional financial aid. For the state to try the states to try to match that, it would be an incredible burden. So the concern about the closure of small colleges is not just that you lose the legacy or that there is job loss, although those things are very concerning as well. It's that you now have a population of students who had been served who are no longer being served. Where would they go? The other quick thing I would say is that there's a huge range within that universe of very small institutions. We just heard about Presentation College in South Dakota. They announced their closure this week. Small Catholic institution, the Order of Sisters that has supported that institution, often through a lot of volunteer work, has been shrinking. They have found it difficult in their more rural environment to attract students. But other institutions in that small college group are really thriving and succeeding. They, you know, you could think of Berea College with its $1.6 billion endowment. You could think of Paul Quinn College in Dallas, which is rethinking how HBCUs function. Philander Smith College in Arkansas, which has dramatically turned around its financial picture by doing creative things such as beginning a school of public health to help meet local employment needs. There's just a wide range. And I think each institution, part of why this challenge is so difficult for leaders is that each institution has to find its niche, the students it can serve within its financial parameters. There is no magic bullet or single solution.
Right. But do you agree with Lee Gardner, this idea that, I mean, dire as this enrollment cliff is, and some of these challenges that are facing these schools, it has forced perhaps some positive consequences and sort of some innovative changes. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think crisis always has an opportunity. One of my leadership mottos was always don't waste a good crisis. And I think, you know, you also are in an industry that has been significantly disrupted. Would we say that the closure of local newspapers, for example, has had some positive consequences? Perhaps, right? There is certainly more free access to information and innovation and web and different sorts of news reporting. On the other hand, we know that without the investigative reporting that goes on that local newspapers provided, there are a lot of things that are being underreported or ignored, and not a market is not being served. And
yeah, I think I'd weigh that last point more than the first. But go ahead. Yeah. I mean, just throwing in my 2 cents worth.
In terms of the loss of local reporting.
I'm with
you, Anthony. Yeah. So, you know, I would say there's a double-edged sword here as well, right?
Yeah,
are there good things about these contractions? Absolutely, right? Efficiency, innovation. You know, real attention to the needs of a wider range and a more diverse range of students, those are very positive. But, you know, we are also seeing the lopping off and the eradication of forms of education, of fields of study that I think we will perhaps not see the full impact of for, you know, another 5 to 10 years.
Sure.
What happens when we have no no more poets? What happens if we have no more sociologists? Those are going to be significant losses. So right. We do have to think about what it is that these institutions provide culturally and collectively beyond just the benefit to the individual student.
No more sociologists in training, no more poets in training. I mean, that's a profound idea that you put on the table there, Marjorie, and I appreciate that. Lee, I just want to come back to it's almost like a sort of factual question about numbers, because Marjorie talked about 135 very small colleges. When you talk about, you sort of identified them as micro colleges with enrollments of about 1,000, and I think your number was a little higher. We're talking about, 400 or something of these schools around the country? Is that right?
Some of the data people at the Chronicle went through federal data and found that in 2020, which is the last year that we had federal data available, there were 435 private colleges with 1,000 students or fewer.
And that number was...
Yeah, go ahead, Marjorie.
Oh, I was just saying, my data doesn't contradict that. I was looking at those that are members of CIC, which would be, Lee is talking about a larger universe.
I got you. Yeah.
Right. And that number was actually up substantially from 2010, when there were about 395. And considering that a number of the colleges on that list have closed, and this was a contentious fact for some readers, seems to indicate to me that a number of institutions have been continuing to lose enrollment. And, you know, when a college gets that small, it's just difficult, because not only are you subject to those fluctuations of enrollment, even more subject to those fluctuations of enrollment and therefore tuition dollars, but you just have fewer resources, you have fewer cushion. You know, if you have to cut, there's way less fat, or, you know, possibly no fat left to cut.
Right.
So things just, you know, are sort of naturally precarious when you get down to a certain level. But that said, you know, I mean, there are a lot of great schools, successful schools at that level who offer something terrific. So it's not like, you know, there's no life there. There's no value there. It's just that it can be tough for some of the schools at that range.
And Marjorie Haas, go ahead. You were going to add something to that.
I would just say I would agree with that, both from my perspective at CIC, but also as a college president. In the institutions I led, we did find it much easier to have a stable financial picture when we were closer to 2,000 students. That sub 100, sub 1,500. You just have a lot of particularly regulatory costs and other kinds of things that you just can't, you just don't have enough students to sort of spread that across. Large endowments obviously help, and private philanthropy often make that up at some of those institutions, but certainly not at all.
Marjorie Haas, our time is winding down, but I'd love to get a final thought of you. You know, as you look around your universe of colleges, and in particular with a focus on small colleges, what gives you the most hope? I mean, do you see examples of smaller colleges offering innovative approaches to attracting students, or whatever it is that makes you feel okay about this or hopeful about this?
I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful because of the caliber of leadership that these institutions are able to support. We see also an incredible range of new models of collaboration emerging. There are companies and social businesses and foundations that are stepping forward to help our institutions collaborate. Boards are willing to have these more difficult conversations earlier in the process. I think the shift in environment and the pandemic made it less... embarrassing for institutions to say, hey, we really better look at our business model.
Right.
And it means that these conversations can be had more openly and before we've hit a crisis point. And that gives more room and more time for creative solutions.
Right.
And the thing that always gives me hope is our students.
Our students. Sorry to cut you off there, but
no worries. The
time is winding down. Ending on a note of hope there, despite the enrollment cliff. Marjorie Haas, president of the Council of Independent Colleges. Thanks so much, Marjorie. We really appreciate it.
It was a true pleasure. Thank you.
And Lee Gardner, senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, who covers the management of the university and how leaders navigate change. Lee, thanks for reporting. Thanks for being on the show.
Happy to help.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.